But today is VE Day, the boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm Zach, a reporter at Citywire. I'm joined by chief reporter Nicola Blackburn and data journalist Alicia Hagopian. And welcome to our monthly roundup. Hey, guys, how are you?
We're doing great, Zach. Thank you.
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks, Zach.
It's been another massive month for us, I think it's fair to say, here at Citywire. We started off the month with what's a hectic budget day for us journalists. Journalists are always sort of running around and you always feel like everything is breaking. Although, did you guys feel there was that much in the budget? I personally didn't. I mean, we had the launch of a Great British ISA with an extra £5,000 allowance for UK assets. We had the non-dom tax status that was scrapped. But apart from that, for me, it felt a little bit on the slow side.
I mean, I think, yeah, the British ISA, that's one that's been touted about for a while. So that was probably the biggest change. Mm. But at the end of the day, it's a bit unclear what that will look like. It's a bit unclear whether that will happen because the elections are coming up this year as well. So we'll see if it comes in time to not be changed. But the budget itself, not much on my end.
No, I agree. I think the ISAs was the biggest announcement of interest to advisors, because we had a few of them say that it was good to have this kind of tax break, you know, almost to like replace other tax breaks that were no longer there. Hmm. But I mean, we're talking about like £5,000. It wasn't that significant.
A bit of tinkering here and there. I mean, I guess non-dom tax status being scrapped will matter for non-dom clients, but there aren't that many of those out there. Although 68,000, I think, in the UK.
There was another big piece of news around that time. I'd say we had an internal people move at Citywire.
Yeah, I mean, there was big news for me. I moved to Citywire Wealth Manager. Still doing these podcasts, but now do report for Wealth Manager, which is just fascinating because wealth firms have so many parallels with financial planning firms and yet so many differences. I mean, the scale of what you're talking about is often very different. I guess the non-dom stuff actually in the budget matters a lot more for wealth firms who deal with high net worth clients, really. The space isn't as fragmented as financial planning. Mm.
I think that should be really interesting for you. And also there's a lot of crossover. A lot of wealth managers are also offer a bit of advice. And on that note as well, we have another person who's just joined the team, Julian Bovill. So feel free to reach out to him if you want to give him any non-regulated advice.
Julian is already set on some really interesting stories. Today, we'll mainly be talking about SJP. There have been so many developments at the UK's largest advice firm. To start us off, I'll just start by saying, you know, that last month the shares crashed after it set aside £426 million for advice fee refunds. I mean, there are so many layers to this. Alicia, would you mind getting us started just on the shares crash themselves?
Yeah, so it's been a real whirlwind for SJP in the last year and in the last few months, especially. And I think we say that quite often, but this time it's really true. Mm-hmm. So if you've been following any of our reporting, we reported on a bunch of different fee changes, some investors pulling out, some investors buying in. But in February, I think it was, SJP released their annual results, and there were some really big surprises in that. The biggest of it being that they've had to set aside £426 million to deal with a huge barrage of complaints about not receiving ongoing advice. So that is something I don't think that any of us could have predicted, but there's been a lot of reporting around that. More specifically, SJP has 950,000 clients across the UK, and something like 2% of clients in the last year alone did not receive their ongoing advice reviews, which means that they are due a refund of those ongoing advice fees. The thing is that they've launched a review that is going all the way back to 2018. So that's six different years. And I would imagine that that 2% goes even higher the further back we go, because SJP has pointed back to the fact that they have only implemented Salesforce, which allows them to have sort of all their data in one place in 2022, 2021, something like that. So you have years of sort of all these thousands and thousands of advice firms across the UK that are partner practices, not having that centralized source of information about whether they've given ongoing advice. So this could be something that, you know, that 426 million could really increase. It could also decrease, but I'd say that's very unlikely. And a result of this was that the shares crashed massively around that time. They still haven't rebounded fully. And they've been, this isn't the first crash there's been though in the last year. Like in the last few years, the shares have been going down and down and down, and especially impacted by the fee changes that were announced at different points last year, which I think you've covered. So really a difficult time, and especially a difficult time for Mark Fitzpatrick, who's the SJP CEO, who only joined in the end of December. So he's been there for about a month and a half and been slapped in the face with all of this. So I think that's a bit of a challenge.
The thing about that 426 million figure that strikes me is, like, on the one hand, SJP have set that aside as a provision for potential compensation, I guess, if clients weren't receiving that ongoing service. But then on the other hand, how much is it going to cost in terms of time and money, SJP, to backtrack for their, what is it, thousands of partner firms across the UK whose data is all kind of held separately in things before 2022 in order to review those advice files? Like, that's just surely going to be a mammoth process. So, I mean, how much is that going to cost SJP?
I think that's a really good point, and especially because they have said that they will be refunding advice fees, not just when it's proven that somebody didn't receive advice, but when there's no evidence of them receiving advice. So if some of these firms don't have records, then, well, they should have been keeping those records, but still they could be facing those fee refunds. And at the end of the day, both the CEO and the CFO have mentioned that those individual advisors and advice firms could be facing that bill if they're the ones who didn't provide the advice. I guess that makes sense. And, you know, something that Zach noticed actually right before the results, so kind of did get a bit of a sneak preview, was about the hiring of a bunch of new complaint staff. Don't know if you can talk about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And having a go at SJP for essentially keeping money that you know, is arguably owed to the client, it can be a bit hypocritical.
Yeah, and I think also in terms of, you know, an annual review, it's interesting to advisors listening to this podcast because they'll be thinking, right, in terms of evidence of advice to pass the FCA's sort of checks and balances on this, what do I need to have evidenced in the age of consumer duty as well? What do I need to evidence to make sure that advice has been provably given, right? And the threshold, obviously the FCA has said the absolute bare minimum really is an annual review. And of course, we know about how advice is an old sector. And, you know, sometimes we're going back 20 years, 30 years. But of course, from now, it's an annual review. And the FCA has been quite clear about that. I wonder if that's the kind of chatter you guys are hearing from advisors in terms of them talking about their own clients and, you know, what kind of evidence they've got. I'm thinking particularly of smaller firms.
I think that if we look at the SJP example and kind of compare it, the SJP is the largest advice firm in the UK by a mile, as we were discussing earlier. And I think that the issue of scale can be a benefit and a challenge when it comes to proving ongoing advice, because on the one hand, you have the resources to have like a really tight centralized data system. On the other hand, you have literally thousands of employees around the UK all using different sorts of things. Because as you said, advice is a very old profession. I think that with a smaller firm, it's almost easier to keep your ducks in a row because you're involved as a one-man or two-man IFA, you're more involved in every step of the process, and things can get a bit tricky the larger the firm becomes. But I do think that where smaller firms will and are struggling, from conversations that I had at the NMA conference, is that sort of need to have a software for this, a software for that, digitizing everything, but at the same time, no software quite does everything. Or, you know, some of them promise to, but others don't. And you get used to your clients and yourself and your company using one type of software, then you're told, actually, you need this. But I think at the end of the day, I know that some advisors listening might be quite resistant to buying new digital products and spending more and more, which kind of ups their advice fee at the end of the day. But I think that this ongoing advice evidencing is, you know, also crucial to consumer duty, and that's not going away. And at the end of the day, if we're looking 5 years from now, I think that the advice sector is going to be extremely digitized, and you need to provide evidence of everything. And I mean, if it can hit the largest advice firm in the UK, and if they can have been caught off guard by this, imagine how it's going to affect your small business. And I would say, don't think that you're going to be any less on the line just because you're a small business. Mm-hmm. You still should be proving that you have had that ongoing review with the client, whether it's going to their house for a cup of tea or whether it's a more formal, interaction, you need to be logging that. You need to be having some proof of that, and some proof that you've checked whether what you're giving them is suitable. And, you know, we'll come onto this later, but everything from their platforms to their providers and things like that.
I think there's another side to this though, where, I mean, the thing is, like, think about if you're an advised client that has really complex and changing financial needs, and things are popping up regularly that you need to talk to your advisor about. And let's say one day you have a chat with your advisor because all of a sudden, you know, you inherit some money, and you have a really long session with your advisor about that. And then they do a long session with your mother about that because it affects her too. And then 2 weeks later, you're due your ongoing review. You're probably not going to need a big meeting with the advisor at that yearly review point, because you've had this ad hoc interaction with them and you think the service has been really good. But from a kind of standardized regulatory perspective, that doesn't look good.
Yeah.
I do think there will be questions raised about standardizing this kind of ongoing service approach.
Definitely.
It's like the fine line, you know?
I think that's a really good point. I might certainly add some advice. It's interesting, because sometimes I'll look and I'll see a client hasn't had an ongoing review, an annual review, and I'll say, oh, okay, so I'll keep a better eye on them. And it's a bit more informal, but they are very well-meaning.
Yeah.
So, but it's an interesting thing of where that point lies.
Yeah, because surely that doesn't mean they're not receiving a good ongoing service.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's sort of the FCA's never-ending battle between being proactive, but also being too burdensome.
Totally, right?
And Alicia, I just want to ask you as well about, you know, coming back to that 426 million, I wonder where that's all going to come from, because obviously SJP have set that aside. But I heard some murmurs that it could potentially come from other sources, i.e. their advice partners.
Yeah, so it's an interesting point. In the sort of analyst presentation and things like that, I think that the CEO mentioned that he thinks it's a quite a generous estimate. They're not trying to be penny pinching, because they want to make sure that they're sort of covered their bases. So there definitely is a possibility that 426 million could be a generous estimate, but, you know, there is a possibility it could be larger, because if you think about what's got to be in that, it's not just 426 million of refunds.
Mm.
They're hiring 90 new staff. Mm. I mean, that is immense. They have 1 million customers. Mm. They have to go all the way back through this strategic review for 6 years. They have to get lawyers and legal fees. I don't know how much of that is actually covered in the 426 million. It was hard to sort of distinguish that in the results, but I'm sure we'll learn more about that. But yes, they mentioned, and then they sort of doubled down on it, that if a specific partner is found to have not given ongoing advice, and there's clear evidence of that, they haven't said that they will always do it, but they've said that they will be seeking compensation from the partner. Mm. So let's say that you're an advice firm and an advice partner at SJP, and you have sort of 20 clients who haven't received an annual review. That's going to go out of your salary, right? And that could be a real hit to some businesses. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's probably the logical option, right? Because otherwise the entire partnership, those thousands of advisors, will be having to pay that back for you. But the question is with that, A, how often will they be able to prove that it was on the partner? And the other part of that is, will that be reducing the 426 million or will that be on top of the 426 million? It's quite difficult to say, and they haven't clarified
but,
that.
But also, presumably, one of the attractions of being an SJP partner is that SJP will help you out with regulatory responsibility.
Yes.
Which goes out the window if they're then blaming it on the partners, right?
Exactly. So I think putting that burden on the partners, I think, should be making a few thousand of those partners very concerned right now and should be making them trying to clean up their shop a little bit. Mm. But at the end of the day, if the SJP policy is you need to provide ongoing service and you haven't performed that, then this shouldn't have been a surprise to you as a practice. The other thing, though, on that is, yes, maybe you just didn't provide adequate evidence of it. And we spoke to one of SJP's major investors, which is Harris Associates. I think they're the third largest shareholder currently. And one of the fund managers essentially said to us, you know, we're confident in the management on this, but we are definitely looking to the fact that they are going to try and get those refunds from the individual partners. So I think in terms of SJP investors, the people who are, you know, you mentioned the share crash, the people who are investing in the business, they obviously don't want SJP as a whole to be paying any more than they have to be. They're already performing the review. They're already hiring all these staff and dealing with the complaints. So they do not want the business to be bearing any of the burden on that. So you've got the investors on one side, the partners on the other. And I think it is worth returning to that claims management point you were making, that this could become a bit of a feeding frenzy, a bit like British Steel almost, you know, where there's a big group of vulnerable people that might have been not received suitable service, right? Mm. And this is in the press, you know, we're publishing about it, the FT is publishing about it. That's a real big opportunity for people to be targeted. And I think it's important to say that, yeah, maybe go directly to SJP. Otherwise, you'll just make even more of a loss than you would have otherwise, you know?
I think it's also worth saying that it is definitely not in the regulator's interest for the UK's biggest advice firm by a country mile to, you know, fall into serious financial difficulties because it has this huge liability based on past poor ongoing advice. You know, the FCA is the regulator of competition in this sector in the UK, do not want to see that happen. So, you know, potentially, definitely a really kind of good thing for SJP if they have been kind of working closely with the regulator on this provision and how it's going to be doled out, if it needs to be doled out and all of that. We'll see.
I think, you know, that's a really interesting point. And I think to just transition a little bit, the FCA has been working closely with SJP on this, but, you know, I think there was also a lot of discussion last year about SJP's fees and especially their exit fees. Mm. And, you know, among those discussions and those FCA papers that were released in letters, they did decide to remove their exit fees. they did decide to remove their exit fees, albeit in a few years. I think there's been a really big focus from the regulator on fees. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think this ties in, of course, with the Consumer Duty, right? Like this all goes back to the Consumer Duty. But what we have seen over the past year and what we've, I think, probably all wrote a few stories about, actually, is advice firms, some major advice firms in the UK, changing their fee models. And a popular way that it's been done, this isn't really what SJP did because they have so many fees, different types of fees, but with Fairstone and Kingswood are the two that come to mind, they opted for like a standardized fee model, a sort of one fee for most clients model. And, you know, their justification is obviously it's just a sort of fairer, one size fits all, less complicated model. So just an example, Kingswood's new standardized fee is 75 basis points. But look, personally, I'm really interested in this topic because I think, again, this goes back to the question of, yeah, but this is one very broad brush way of defining value, of going, you know, in order to make sure that everyone seems the same, you know, receives an equal good service, we'll just charge everyone the same fee. But look, the reality, we all know the reality of financial advice isn't that. The reality of financial advice is like advisors have some clients who have complex needs and some clients who have simpler needs. Mm-hmm. And everyone has things that pop up that they don't expect that means they need to see their financial advisor. So you know, of course an advisor is going to have one client who, yeah, every client's different, but now, you know, a Kingswood advisor might have to charge at least most of its clients the same fee. I just can't believe that is going to go down smoothly.
It's really interesting because as we see these changes across the board, really, I mean, taking Fairstone for an example, you know, they introduce a new single offering replacing their sort of tiered structure, right? But the new single offering is 5 basis points higher than the previous standard service. Mm-hmm. So you've now got clients who were receiving a standard service, and it's now being the price is now being raised by 5 basis points. And they have no other option really to go to if they don't want to. But now, of course, in the reality, most clients will be like, okay, 5 basis points, it's the same thing, yeah, whatever. But really, there's not a tangible improvement there. Mm. At least we're not being told of a tangible improvement. Yeah. Meaning that if you're a client, I think you could quite rightly be aggrieved by having to pay a higher price, really.
Particularly because like a lot of higher asset clients will get a discounted fee, right?
Yes.
Like that's often how it works. So yeah, under this model, like surely more of the higher, like the clients that are bringing in more money for the firm are having their fees raised, I imagine.
Combined with this is the sort of increasing, combined with this is more hybrid models. So we're seeing, as we see a sort of greater focus on value from the regulator, what we then see with firms is thinking a greater focus on, okay, can we afford to service all of these clients? And a hybrid way is often much cheaper way of doing that. So, you know, sticking with the Fairstone example, you know, they launched a remote digital advice service a while ago, which charged a relatively low 93 basis points all in. That's for advice, that's for portfolio, that's for platform fees. And it's interesting that a lot of advice firms seems to have worked out that, you know, it's only worth your time over a certain amount of assets, really. Mm. So clients could potentially face a cliff edge who don't have that many assets.
Yeah.
And of course, with all these changes from the regulator looming on in the background is the thematic retirement income advice review. There was news on that, wasn't there, Nicola?
Yes, indeed. This was finally published just last week, I think. And it's something that we've all been anticipating for some time, because we wrote several stories last year about advice firms being sent surveys asking for a bit of information, and then more information, and then more information, and then more information about basically everything to do with their centralized retirement propositions. What came out last week, it was very wide ranging. It asked advisors about everything from their fees to their choice of platform and how often they review it, to their attitude to risk assessments and how often they do it. And it's actually, if nobody has read the paper, even though it's hundreds of pages long, it's worth having a look at, because the FCA includes examples of good and poor practice in relation to all those different parts of the service. And there are little anecdotes from advice firms about what's being done well and what's not being done well. So it's actually quite interesting, quite insightful. I think two things to say about it that particularly stood out to me. One was there was a real focus on cash flow modeling tools and just cash flow modeling in general, and the discrepancy, I think, in how advisors approach it. Some are kind of relying on their own assumptions and models in-house. Others are using outsourced tools. And there was a separate letter published with the review kind of asking advice firms to review it. And, you know, it's pretty clear that the FCA wants like a standardized approach to cash flow modeling. So that's going to be quite impactful for firms, and we'll kind of see how that rolls out, I guess, and evolves. And the other interesting thing that I wanted to flag was, I think, just the way that the FCA went about reviewing it. So they spoke to hundreds of firms about all these themes, but then there were 24 firms that they requested more information from. So the implication is that those firms were kind of, there were serious shortfalls in their retirement advice processes. And then the FCA presented findings on those 24 cases, but I think it was either 10 or 14. It was like about half of the cases the FCA couldn't review as part of the findings because there was insufficient information provided or something. The advice firms didn't provide enough information. So a lot of their findings were based on about 10 firms. And there was no indication of whether these were the biggest firms or whether they were just a random... Mm. I think they were just a random selection. So some of them could have been really small. So I think... Like, there are a lot of things that the FCA says needs improving in terms of advisor services, but a lot of the data was based on, like, 10 firms.
Yeah, I mean, I would say as well with that, though, that the thing that stood out to me was, you know, across 231 firms, 2.9% of customers paid for but did not receive an annual review.
Across 231,
which okay. obviously links to what we were saying earlier, but that's huge. 2.9% is quite, like, obviously, you know, got the data journalists here to tell me about the numbers and if they're correct or not. However, if you would extrapolate that, one would think in theory this could be, you know, pretty big.
But that's like four firms of 231.
2.9% of customers.
Oh, okay. Across all the 231. Yeah. Okay.
But
okay,
then if you think about that, like 231 firms, I mean, you could have, what, 50 clients at each firm, but you can also have over 1,000 clients at each firm.
Yeah,
so right. that, and that's if you, a lot of customers. If, yeah. I guess you're actually completely right, Nicola, that the problem with these kind of reviews with a small sample, who knows if that would mean that across the entire UK advice market, like 2.9%, or if it's just at these few firms. But
yeah,
I think it's interesting that you said that about half of them didn't provide sufficient information because I thought they would be obliged to.
I think it was because some of them just didn't have it. Yeah. So that's quite telling, right? Like the SA1 information about reviews and things like that and how they kind of, what their processes were, and these advice firms didn't have records. But again, if anyone wants like a really broad brush, just insight into other advice firms' processes, from anything from like assessing attitude to risk to whether or not they have a centralized investment proposition and what it is, have a look at the paper. It's very interesting.
That does sound really interesting.
It will probably come as no surprise that, you know, one of the many areas that the FCA addressed in the paper was platforms and how often advice firms were reviewing their choice of platforms as well as product providers and everything. But I think, you know, platforms is something that we cover a lot on NMA, and there's been some big news that's affected that sector over the past year and probably made some advisors think twice about the platforms that they have chosen to use for different clients. One of those sort of issues was the issue of platforms double dipping. And Alicia, we had a pretty big story on this last month.
Yeah, so Vicky, who is our platforms reporter and isn't here right now in the studio. She did this great story. So, you know, on the 29th of February, there was sort of a deadline that the FCA gave platforms where they had said, essentially, you know, if you are found to be doing anything non-consumer duty compliant by this point, that will start to be a problem and we will take action. And one of the main things that refers to is something we call double dipping, which is essentially charging clients for their assets held on the, you know, which is essentially charging clients a platform fee, but on top of that, taking a huge margin on interest on cash. And that's, you know, a few years ago, this really wasn't a problem because cash interest rates in the UK were extremely low. But then now, because they've shot up, the problem is that a lot of platforms have not returned that client interest. And it kind of, for advisors, this really begs a question of, is that the most appropriate platform for your client? Because could you be gaining a sort of, you know, 4% interest just on plain client cash in a bank or on another platform, to name one, Transact, which is probably the best for that because they return the majority of the client cash interest. And so Vicky just did recently a story in the lead up to the 29th of February on 8 platforms that are still taking some form of client cash interest, even as the deadline passed. And I think that's quite brazen in a way. It's very interesting to see how that will play out. It's quite unclear what will actually happen, but the FCA were quite clear that they do not think that that is a positive outcome for clients. some of these platforms have not quite said that they're still taking that client cash interest, but it's interesting they're starting to call it a treasury fee or a treasury cost, because they don't really want to call it cash interest because that's a bit polarized. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, Morningstar Wealth, Nucleus, Aegon, a few on here that might be quite surprising to you. And I think what's interesting as well is that following up from that, we had the Aberdeen results, and the interactive investor head, Richard Wilson, essentially doubled down on it again and said, you know, we provide competitive rates on cash, but we still think that those cash interest rates belong to our platform. Mm. And that's quite a bold thing to say when you know that the regulator is probably going to be looking at your business with a magnifying glass. Mm. So I wonder what are your thoughts on that? I just want to add that one interesting factor is that, you know, in the US, from what I've heard, a lot of the platforms don't charge an actual platform fee. But they take that cash interest. So that's kind of how I wouldn't quite call it cross-subsidizing, but that's how they gain their profit. I think that's quite interesting. So I heard that is a model that they use in the US. So maybe it's just that we're not used to that model here. Mm. But at the end of the day, for the platforms to be doing that is one thing. I guess that's their choice. Another question is, as an advisor, you know, going back to the ongoing suitability and things like that, if you're recommending that your client stays on a platform where they're getting basically nothing back from their cash, and if they've got 100,000 in cash or something like that, you know, that is something that if you're providing a review, the regulator is going to look at and say, hang on, that can't be the best choice for your client. Mm. So I think there might be an element of advisors putting pressure on the platforms themselves.
Yeah.
Because you, as an advisor, I mean, we've all heard this, you don't want to move your clients. It's extremely like heavy process. There's delays on one side, delays on transferring them over, delays from getting them onboarded. Your client's like, well, why did you recommend me to this platform in the first place? So at the end of the day, you don't want to have to transfer your clients. But so part of that is sort of lobbying your platforms themselves a bit and saying, look, I don't want to move my clients, but this one element, whether that's platform cash or the service, is not okay. And I think that's some dynamic that we might start seeing with Consumer Duty. And I'd love to hear from any of you if you've had that experience.
Well, I think it's just interesting about, it's really sort of ties into the FCA's focus on transparency, really, because the issue of double dipping is sort of, you know, having your cake and eating it too. And, you know, and it's just everyone being aware of what's going on as well in that process. You know, the FCA has constantly got to focus on, is this advice firm the best for this client? Why have you chosen this product? Why have you chosen this fund? Why have you chosen this platform? And to demonstrate that that is in the best interest of the client.
Yeah, I do. It's interesting this because it's obviously very regulation driven. Like the FCA imposes tight deadline on platforms to stop double dipping. And there'd been a lot of talk from the regulator about it previously. But obviously, you know, these cash accounts, because they exist just basically as a little pool of cash for fees to be taken out of. And if investors are, you know, worried when markets are choppy, if they're worried about their investments, they can just temporarily chuck their cash in there. It's not a major issue of, you know, investors holding, you know, the majority of investors won't be holding an enormous amount of cash in these accounts at one time. So I do wonder with, and again, because it's so driven by the regulator, I wonder if for the advisors, this whole cash interest topic is more of a moral thing, where advisors are looking at their providers and going, look, this isn't having a massive financial impact on my clients who, you know, whatever. Yeah. But it's not having a massive financial impact on my clients, but hey, this feels really sneaky. This wasn't something I was aware of. This wasn't something I was aware that didn't need to happen. So I mean, do I want to move my client? You know, am I really unhappy with my platform? And do I want to move my clients to another platform? I feel like if the answer is yes, there might be other issues they have with their platform, not just the cash interest thing. But very interested to hear any listeners think about
that. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. Lastly, I did just want to talk, Alicia, about a couple of your stories. Slightly more on the fun side, away from you know, charging fee overhauls and share crashes. I noticed there was a story you did about some A-level students, and they were taking on a London asset manager. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think we all maybe met them because they came around the office. But so it was really great. We had four A-level students come down from the Isle of Wight on the ferry. Yeah, the sustainability-focused advisor, Chris Wellsford from the Isle of Wight, has sort of led this research project with these four A-level students at Christ the King College, I think it is. And they did a research project on this one holding called Smurfit Kappa, which is a recycling company. And they presented to Web Asset Management on why they believe that the investment might not be ethical. And they just had a really great experience. And I have to say, and I really do mean this, I read the research report before speaking to them. And it was so professional. It was so well put together, completely perfectly sourced. I mean, I was really convinced by some of the arguments that they made. And I mean, Chris, who's the advisor, he said that he actually wasn't involved in any of the work. He just sort of like trimmed it up a little bit. So it was really cool. And there were some really great people, and I'm sure they'll go
far. Were they quite passionate?
They were very passionate. I think they were a bit shy at first, but they really warmed up. There was definitely one who was a bit more confident than the others, but they all definitely had a lot to say. And to be honest, I was asking them some questions where I thought, like, you have better opinions than me on this, like truly.
And what was the outcome of the engagement with Web?
So I think it's hard to say, but they engaged with the some of the people who are the researchers on this fund. And they said that, you know, it's great to have this report and we'll definitely take it into account. You know, the students said that they weren't necessarily, that Web didn't seem surprised by any of the revelations, but I think that probably this research, the way they put it together, will be quite impactful, maybe for their future decisions. So who knows? We'll have to keep an eye on their holdings their impact funds. But, you know, it was just nice to get them into the office and talk a bit about fund management, asset management, and the advice space. And, you know, they seem pretty well educated for Gen Z.
I hope it'll have some impact, particularly if NMA are covering it. Any A-level students who have sustainability concerns, please get in touch. We'd love to give you a promo and challenge some of these, you know, big firms.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, you know, A-level students, not media trained, very, very well informed. You know, we'd love to hear more from you guys. I think we need a bit more excitement in this office, you know, sometimes. but yeah, if you want to read that article, it's up on the website. So yeah.
Fantastic, fantastic. And Alicia, I also saw a sort of lighter story from you on city celebrities. I believe this was about cash management provider Flagstone.
Yeah, so this was quite a unexpected story because Flagstone, which is this cash management sort of platform used by SJP and a few others, they have just received some private equity investment from Estancia Capital Partners. And, you know, the team and I were just looking through some of the shareholders and we noticed one or two names that stood out. And then the names just sort of kept going and kept going. And I really think it's the biggest celebrity list of shareholders that I've personally ever seen. I can't quite say why they've chosen Flagstone. There must have been some sort of mysterious bidding war. This isn't even all of them, by the way. But, you know, a few finance big wigs that we've seen, but we've also got so in terms of politics, we've got Lord Terry Burns, who was a former Treasury Secretary, Baron Mervyn Davies, who's the former Labour Minister of Trade. On a really interesting one was Richard Branson's two children, Sam Branson and Holly Branson, and then Holly's husband, Freddie Andrews. They're both quite, you know, substantial shareholders, in addition to the CEO of Virgin Money. Unfortunately for us, Richard Branson himself was not a shareholder. That would have been a great story. But, you know, I'm definitely curious to know what was the impetus for them all getting invested. And then, you know, we've got the chair of Saltus and the former chairman of Interactive Investor, Hugo van Redenbach. I think that's how you say it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a few other lords and ladies. And I mean, if the list really did keep going, and I would have loved to be in the room when this was being pitched, because maybe I would have bought in, you know.
So just to be clear, when you say a cash management platform, what do you mean? Because I'm also struggling to see what the appeal is of Flagstone, frankly, for all these famous shareholders.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say that. Let me just make sure I get this absolutely right, but I think it could tie into what we've been talking about on cash interest, because it's specifically a tool by which you can invest clients' cash via various banks. So because right now the interest rates are so high, I mean, this must be just an incredible time to be working in cash, frankly.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, the platform must have been doing very well, because clients who are invested via this platform, they can access all these sort of thousands of different interest rates at like competitive prices,
so it
from different banks.
The best rate for their money that they're just holding in cash, basically.
Exactly. And I imagine how it works is that Flagstone takes a small cut off that. So if interest rates are so high, I mean, it's pretty much a no-brainer.
Got it.
But yes, I don't, it's not exactly the sexiest proposition from my perspective. So I wonder what, you know, the CEO of Virgin Money found in this, but maybe he can reach out and tell us.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Or Richard Branson's children.
Yeah, yeah, I'd encourage Richard Branson or any celebrity shareholders to get in touch with us. You can find us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Guys, thank you so much for this monthly roundup. This has been wonderful, and it's like, it's not wonderful, is it? Guys, thank you so much for joining me on this monthly roundup. It's been another busy month, and I'm sure next month will be just the same. You've been listening to The Advice Show with myself, Zakaria Sharif, chief reporter Nicola Blackburn, and data journalist Alicia Hagopian. For any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or email us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Today is VE Day. The war is over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.